Hi, this is Jenna Grayson coming into you live. This is the Hypnotic Comic Show, and I am your host, the Hypnotic Comic, masterfully bringing together the gift of hypnosis for therapeutic purposes and some good old-fashioned comedy. So today on our show, we have a really extraordinary and very intelligent and masterful guest. It is Nicole Buffett. She is the granddaughter of Warren Buffett, the second most, second wealthiest person in the world, as well as the greatest investor in our own time, or actually the greatest investor of all times. And Nicole is an extraordinary human being in her own consciousness, in her own art. She's an artist and a healer, and she is creating medicine mandalas for people, and she's a really joyful and great guest, and I'm so grateful to have her on. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the show and about myself just for a moment before we switch over to Nicole. So I like to announce when my next comedy shows are. We just had one this last Friday at the Comedy Store, August 24th, which was so much fun, in the original room, which is where Dave Chappelle has been performing, which is pretty rad. So I'm kind of excited about that. And if you guys want to call in at any point with any comments or questions for Nicole or for me, here is the number, and I'll give it to you one more time a little bit later during the show. We'll check in again. The number to call in is 888-627-6008. Again, that's 888-627-6008. I'm Jenna Grayson, and I'm also a hypnotherapist. I said that briefly, and so I also help people to overcome fears or anxieties, phobias they're having, so they can live more fulfilling, more gratifying, exciting, fun lives. So, as I said a moment ago, our guest today is Nicole Buffett. Welcome to the show, Miss Nicole.
Thank you so much, Jenna. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, my dear. So I'm so honored to have you here and grateful. You are a pretty extraordinary human being. I know that you've both experienced a lot, gone through a lot, and had, while you've had a lot of privileges being the granddaughter of Nicole Buffett, you've also pushed through a lot of challenges that this life has posed for you, and you've had a lot of success in your experiences and been an outspoken person in the name of what you know to be true. And you've been, I know you've been featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show, NPR, the cover of Wall Street Journal, CNBC, did I say CNN yet? So you're pretty well-accomplished girl, young lady. So I feel like I have 1,001 questions for you, and we've only got an hour, so I got to figure out how to put them all into this small space. So first, I just want to welcome you and open up the space for you to introduce yourself and if there's anything you're wanting to share as we're getting started here.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jenna. I know there's so much to cover, and I have had an amazing opportunity, and I had the opportunity in many years ago, not that many, but quite a bit of time ago, where I had a chance to share my story. I was in a documentary called The 1%, and from that documentary, I was asked to go on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and it was really talking about kind of what we're talking about today, but a little more focused on it being about my grandfather, and less, I think, that, you know, today, I know you personally, Jenna, and you know me as an artist, and most of the people in my world know me, I know, primarily as an artist, and then secondarily as Warren Buffett's granddaughter, which I'll say that that's exactly how my grandfather would, and my father and my family would want it to be. So that being said, you know, when in big families of great wealth, in any situation where there's mega wealth, it tends to be complicated, you know, very complicated, where, you know, when you have some people who have a lot and other people who don't have as much, there's an interesting navigation of how you navigate the structure of power and the structure of value. And so, you know, that's always been really fascinating to me. And then just there's the inherent, you know, experience of being human that is the overarching, you know, glue that despite the differences and despite the specificities of all of that, there's just the simple experience of being human. So I guess we can I'll start with saying that. I guess that's the place I like to, and I always just share my experience from. That's a, you know, a shared experience across the board.
Right. I would imagine that being in the role that you're in, just with having people know, I mean, I'm sure some people don't know, but enough people know, and plenty of people know that you're the granddaughter of Warren Buffett, that there's this sense of sort of the opposite, or you being somehow excluded from that experience of being an ordinary human or having an ordinary human experience. Does that seem to be true for you?
Yeah, well, I think my grandfather has a reputation and has had one for many years of not kind of being lavish and not being, not really literally, quite literally buying into kind of materialism and the things that a lot of people with mega wealth kind of do. So right. Because of his reputation, people kind of somewhat innately know that, but there's, I think that there is an assumption that somehow I'm not ordinary or there's something extraordinary about me because of this relationship and relation. And it's funny because it's like both things are true.
Right.
It's a kind of yes and situation where because of that wealth and because of also just how much people immensely respect my grandfather, you know, there's a lot of honor and there's a lot of attention that goes with being his granddaughter. Some attention that's correct and based in reality, and then there's a lot of it that isn't, you know, or assumption, you know, assumptions of me living a certain lifestyle or me being a certain kind of person. So that's always been kind of an interesting process for me, is showing up just as who I am, and either I'm surprising people or I'm not surprising. I'm surprising people, you know, because they thought I'd be something else, and they come to find me as who I am, and they go, wow, this is really cool. You're not, you know, the person I thought you would be. So it generally is very positive. It's really not a negative experience for me most of the time.
Okay. Well, that's good. So it sounds like despite the wealth that you're connected to through your family, that people are finding that you're really relatable and down to earth, which is how I've known you to be. And then you bring up this point that, you know, about this idea of being sort of an ordinary human being, and you are ordinary in some regards, in that I'm going to say you, for one thing, you have all of the ordinary, regular human emotions that we all feel and long for, the sort of ordinary human experiences in terms of wanting to feel fulfilled and connected and loved and enjoy your life and things like that. But at the same time, I want to say to you, but do you think it's actually possible for you to be an ordinary person, you know, because of the wealth that you're connected to? Like, do you find that people ever reflect that to you, or do you ever wonder, like, could I be is it possible to just be an ordinary person if I have such an extraordinarily different life? You know, it's like, you know, we talked about the Buddha living in the kingdom and just thinking that everybody lives like that. And, you know, him coming out into the world and seeing the tremendous human suffering and saying, I had no idea. Not that you've been sheltered in that way, but do you think that there's a part of your awareness that could never be totally ordinary because you've never really known what it is to suffer in ways that let's say, the 99% of the rest of us have. You know, I think what you're saying here is
leading me to consider the idea of access and how the difference between what is ordinary and what is extraordinary. And I think that the difference starts becoming what we've been exposed to and what we also have access to. And that is both can be very reliant upon money and also not reliant at all upon money. And then there's somewhere in the middle where it's a little bit of both. So, for example, I have my grandfather on one hand who was the money man. that's what he did. And then I had my grandmother on the other hand who was the heart and the spirit and the joy and the bliss of all the things that her life were about, which was about spirituality and peace and love and teaching, helping people. And so, you know, things that I got from my grandmother were things that, you know, when you look throughout history, the civilizations that had wealth, there's more artifacts left over from the civilization because they had the time and the resources to create and to make. And there was an extensive exploration of consciousness and of higher learning. And so to me, that is about the access, and that shows how, yes, they had the money, but then what did the money allow them to access? And was money the only way to access that, or is money the only way to access that? And
beautiful.
I think that we as humans we're all stuck in this situation together where there's this thing called money, there's this world we live in. We all have these human desires, all of the ones that you just spoke of. The longing, well, number one to me, is the longing and the needing to belong. I think that, you know, all of the things that we buy and the things that we think that we need are really in between steps to get us to that place of belonging, whether it's belonging to another, a beloved, a person, belonging to our family members, but ultimately that sense of belonging to ourselves and really being connected to who am I and what makes me feel of value here in this life, in this earth. So I guess your question was what between the ordinary and the extraordinary, do I feel like money, where does money kind of stand? And
and is it possible to be ordinary with such an extraordinary amount of money attached to your name?
Yeah, I think, I think that it's funny because I talk about this with my father a lot, and it's been a really big taboo in my family of this idea that, you know, we are not special because we have this money and we are just like everyone else. And I have debate on a consistent basis with my father and with my family where it's really kind of, if special means that I'm above someone, then absolutely not. That's not the kind of special I'm talking about. If special means, wow, I have access to something that I could create anything I want with. I could help others with. I could help myself with it, heal myself. I could live a life that not everyone has access to. So in that way, that is extraordinary and that is special. And then there's also a responsibility to that privilege and to that access. And my father right now, he and his wife have a foundation. My grandfather has given each of his children, I believe, a very large amount of money. I don't know if it's exactly $1 billion, but it's some really big amount of money to give away. My father's foundation is called Novo. And my dad always jokes around that the tagline of his foundation is putting money out of its misery.
Oh, my God.
And
that's hilarious.
getting out of it, putting money out of its misery every day.
Oh my God.
And in that way, it's like, hey, yeah. So if that gives you a sense of the view of money, in that money can generally create so much access, but it also can get in the way, you know, of that connection.
Sure. Yeah, so, I think that's a great dichotomy that you and I have talked about before, with like the role that money plays in the world and in each of our lives. And it's just, it's such an extraordinary thing. You know, one of my greatest teachers is Amma, and she's from India, and she talked about a number of subjects, and I've followed her, you know, both being here in California in the States and then also in India. And what's been remarkable is how she talks about money and how people worry about money and stress about money mm-hmm. the same here in the States and California as she does in India, even though right. you know, people are living with so much less in India, and the rate of poverty, like what we call the poverty line, is, I mean, I'm kind of just saying this, but it's like it would be wealth for them. You know, it's a whole other category mm-hmm. of poverty. But she speaks about the consciousness of it in the same way. It's so extraordinary the ways that, you know, that's, it's so pervasive, regardless, you know, in some ways, regardless of how much money we have, you know. So it's like, you've told me before, you've had $10 in your bank account, and you, sorry, my dogs are going crazy. You've had $10,000, and there's an anxiety that comes with having less money, but it's also like, I want to know, you know, how much is enough? How do we know when enough is that we can say, I'm good. I'm comfortable with what I have access to. I'm willing to be at peace with my life as it is. And I'm curious to ask you in that regard, like, what do you think really drives your grandfather, first of all, with the wealth that he's created for himself and now his family? What do you think is driving that for him?
Well, I think that simply the word creating is what's driving it. I think that for him, making money is his creative act. It's okay. less about the end product and about the creation of it. So it's really wow. his way of tapping into creative energy flows. And that's why he is so detached to the outcome, which is having the money. That's not what it's about for him. My grandmother described it on an interview with Charlie Rose, really near to her death, actually, where she explained to him, she described my grandfather more as like a basketball player who's making a point. You know, every time he makes the money, it's like a point. It's less about, so in a way, it's intangible. You know, it's an energetic achievement that comes from a place of creation. So okay. really, he's an artist, just in the same way I'm an artist, where well, it's less about the end result being the painting. It's that I have to make this, I have to go through this process, and there's some energy that wants to flow through me, and I'm going to make myself available to this creative energy and just go with this and see this through. So it's like the painting is making itself through me. So the, that, and it, in a similar way, it's so big. It's so much bigger than me. It's so much bigger than my grandfather. All of that money is so much greater. You know, I mean, the number, you can't really, what's that number mean? It's just so massive. And it's like, right. I mean, how much? You're saying, what is enough? I mean, back to your your question of like, what is enough? It's like, when you said that, what came to me is and was, you know, enough is a state of mind. You know, enough yeah. is very personal, and it's very much about our ability to see and to experience something. With, you know, we're projecting our own value system on something. So our ability to appreciate something is then what that thing becomes. Its value is based upon our ability to perceive it. Mm-hmm. So if we really appreciate we kind of had this conversation earlier, if we appreciate the simple things in life, I think that that should be a class on wealth, is understanding that wealth in and of itself of any kind, from moderate to massive, is a luxury, in the sense of, if you once you get really connected to what you need and your basic human needs that truly fulfill you and allow you to be whole, whether that's peace, having a safe home, having true nourishment, having fulfilling relationships, being able to express yourself creatively, that to me, those are the true simple needs. So we're not really talking about survival. We're not saying just enough. I'm saying enough. Enough in order to be alive, you know, and thriving.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
do you think that that's a pretty gray area for most of the world in terms of us being able to identify what is the word thriving mean, and what is the word surviving mean? Because I know people who are well employed and doing quite well and worry about money. Like you know, if I could share personally, like I grew up with a very hardworking dad and saw him go from working very small menial, I don't know if menial is quite the right word, but smaller jobs where he was in sales, you know, and selling things. Like initially he was selling candles, and then he was selling cookware, and then he was selling watches. And then he ended up creating this business that was a multi-million-dollar business. And I think I knew my dad to be the most anxious about money when he had a lot more money, you know, like there was the sort of the scarcity mentality that, you know, that energy of just like worry and reviewing a bill from a meal, like with such scrutiny that we would laugh at him, you know, that he'd be like, who had the strawberry lemonade? That thing's $3.25. And we'd be like, what are you doing? But nevertheless, it's like, I guess I'm kind of coming back to like, how do we define what thriving is? How do we define that we've hit the place of I'm surviving, and I can move on from the anxiety of survival into moving into thriving, so that none of us are worrying about money? I know that's something you said, is like, that's the place you want to be, is to be able to just not have to worry about money. And I think that's also a really common thread that so many of us feel, like, if I could just not worry about money, like, how do we get there?
Yeah.
Do you have an answer
to
that?
Well, you know, I mentioned it. Yeah, I mentioned it. You know, this was kind of my big statement on in the film and when I was on Oprah, is just, you know, as simply put, and something we all know, but obviously to be explored, you know, both kind of generally and then very, very personally, you know, we going from fear to love, and our, you know, this fear. So when you're speaking about your father and how it seems like, even though he had wealth and there wasn't so much, there was still that scarcity, and still, you know, that fear was running him. And you know, unfortunately, the motivating catalyst, the force of to motivate, is fear. And I think that even when we're, you know, fear of, I need to belong, I want to find love, I want to, and we all need and deserve to want that and to have that. But when fear becomes our motivation, fear of not having it is our access point, it starts to feed back into the place from where it began, as most things do. Even if it seems like you get really far away, like a snake eating its own tail, it still has to return back to that initial point of birth. It's like that's the place it was created from. So I think that, you know, how do we do this? How do we make it so we don't worry about money? It's like I was sharing with you, I've been just noticing and watching myself over many years, from when I was more struggling more as an artist to not struggling as much, to going back and forth, because, you know, sales are very up and down. You don't know when people are going to buy art. It's not the most stable profession. And really looking at, how do I find my center even when I have $100 in my bank account, or I have $1,000, and then looking at my own sense of well-being, my own sense of calm. Do I have immense anxiety? Where's my self-worth at? And I think that you have to really know that, first off, we've been all conditioned to live in fear around money, and that money in and of itself is, I kind of equate it with like the priest that tells you that you need him to connect to God.
Right.
So it's kind of a, it's a bit of an obstacle.
Okay. Just, I want to ask you to explain that metaphor. I feel like I have a sense of where you're going with the priest and God, but how does that relate to money more specifically?
Well, it's a man-made mechanism of access. So if you want this thing, you have to have this money. So it's the structure of our world, it's the structure of civilization. So obviously, you know, it's something that we have to deal with, but it's, you know, ultimately, somehow what I'm saying is that when we start connecting to to what we actually need to feel happy and whole, we don't need to rely on the priest as much. We don't need to rely on money as much. But if we're totally blown out with that we need all of this stuff in order to get to really where we actually already are, if we would just kind of slow down and really notice and appreciate all that we already have, we're finding that we need it less and less. And so to me, it's a kind of combination of a consciousness shift and also a lifestyle shift, and allocation of resources, how we consume and how we create. So I think that in general, human beings, if human beings were more, you know, supported as creative machines versus machines or beings of consumption, I think that that's where kind of the turn comes in. But the healing point kind of comes in. So I know I'm saying a lot, and it's very big, very big concepts, but I guess the concept of money can be pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, right. And do you find that there's an experience of emotion for your grandfather or your family that is unusual, you know, like if we were to look at, I feel like Nicole, we're speaking with Nicole Buffett right now, by the way, if you just tuned in. So Nicole, I feel like you have the capacity to speak from within the 1%, but also recognizing that from sort of an objective point of view. So even though you have that connection, you've also had the life experiences of being within the 99% in your own relationship with money. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, great. So in recognizing that, that you can step into both roles, and you have been in the position to step into both roles, that you can also be a bridge or a doorway or a key to the door on both sides. And so I would love to ask you about that and ask about your perception. And like, you know, I go back and forth in my mind and thinking about the 1% is the 1% because they know something that the rest of us don't know, or the 1% is the 1% because of the social structures and the governmental structures and the economic structures that keep them that way, you know. And I wonder what you think about that, and is it the law of attraction and how we're thinking and how we're feeling and the emotions of your grandfather, emotions or the thoughts that he has, Or is it really his mind and his intelligence, his genius? Or is there some kind of structure that's upholding that kind of machine, you know, to continue for some grander benefit that keeps the 1%, you know, how do you see that as existing and as it's been?
I think that there's the inner world and there's the outer world. So I think it's a yes and, you know, to everything that you said. I think that, of course, because of who my grandfather is, he has manifested the wealth, and he has created his very unique way of amassing this kind of wealth and creating this kind of wealth. And like I said before, that's really his art form. And that is it comes from a very specific place within and a very focused place. And I think that the idea of where we put our attention and where we put our energy, our creative energy, both psychically, physically, emotionally, is really one of the most powerful things that we resources that we have as humans. So, and then whether or not we have the money to back that up. So if I'm, it's reminding me of a monk that I think lived to, you know, he was over 100 years old, and his health was just wildly vital. And someone asked him, you know, how are you this healthy? He said, I don't think any negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Period. I only think positive thoughts. I've trained my mind to only think positive thoughts. So to me, it has nothing to do with the amount of money that he has. It has to do with how he's harnessing his consciousness. So for him, peace and health is where he put his mental, psychic, emotional energy. For my grandfather.
He being your grandfather. Oh, okay. You're talking about the monk. Okay.
For him, this monk. And so for my grandfather, it's being the man who is a financial genius and master. And so that's where he's put his energy. And I think that, so it's kind of like, yes, there's a bigger structure to our world that we all abide inside of, to whatever extent we do. People who are in finance obviously learn to master that that world, you know, that whole, game. I mean, my grandfather's favorite game is Monopoly. And he said, you know, he always says, this is, you know, I'm just playing Monopoly. It's, to him, it's somewhat of a game, it's diminishing in any way, but it's...
I get that. I actually wanted to ask you that. I was thinking that as you were talking about it, that from that place of creativity, like this is his creation, this is his art. You're making it sound very playful, like there's an energy of playfulness around it where I'm like, wow, that sounds like a fun game if you can find it in that sense, you know? Like I feel like we're touching into something really important here, which is, you know, not just the energy and the emotion around it, but the focus and the genius and all these different pieces that come together. But really that opportunity to say, this is the game that I'm playing.
Right.
This is the game that I'm playing.
Exactly. And where we play, we thrive. You know, when you're playing, you're thriving. You're being alive, you're being present, you are in a place of joy, you're learning, you're growing, you're exchanging, you're playing.
Yeah.
So
I was going to say, you and I met at a Chris Howard weekend workshop, and he said a similar thing, which is that we learn the best in a fun environment, which is a whole other conversation to be had about how children are learning in the environments that we're generally exposed to for the purpose of learning, you know, school systems and things like this. But like, where are we learning about money, and where is it ever fun and playful? So I just feel like that's such an awesome invitation, really, to say, let's flip this whole game on its head and turn it from fear and scarcity and limitation into playfulness and exploration and generosity and creativity.
Yeah, and curiosity. Curiosity. Mm-hmm. I think my father, Peter Buffett, who's Warren Buffett's youngest son, is mm-hmm. not just my father, but also one of my greatest teachers. And I'd say that he has always taught me to be curious about who I am and even looking at the places in myself that I need to work on. You know, where I show up for myself and maybe where I fall short of showing up and why that is. Is that because I'm afraid, or is that because, and what needs to happen so I can release some of that fear and find more access? So I'm really lucky to have had a father who's one of my best friends and someone I look up to and admire very much.
That's amazing. I'm hearing you say the word access a lot. It's such a powerful, potent word. And
yeah,
it's like,
exposure and access. I think I think that probably the most important access that we can have is the access to our own creative selves. And mm-hmm. the question being, what do I need to do and create in my life so that I can create that access point? Mm-hmm. I think it's so unique and so specific and relative to who we each are. But I think when we start asking those questions, we might be surprised in a fun way to find what answers come forward. So,
can you share more about that?
I think that having access to our creative selves might require, for example, I'll speak from my own experience, it requires peace. And when I say peace, I mean I need a certain kind of setting. I need to be quiet. I need to be in a good place of self-care. So it's kind of like everything is connected. So you can't have one thing without the other, which is really the truth of how this whole world works and then how we work as human beings, as this kind of network of energies that are feeding into each other and supporting this greater kind of bigger entity, whether it's called Earth or humanity or, you know, Jenna or Nicole. So if I'm doing my meditation practice, for example, every day, I'm have more access to my creative self. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing the simple things to support my physical body every day, whether that's walking or yoga or just getting enough rest or not walking so that I can get a few more hours of sleep that I really need and really listening to what my body needs, that's going to allow me to have greater access to my creative self.
Okay. Do you feel like
so
that's
very
one of
kind
your...
of mundane?
Yeah, it is very mundane. And it's like, as I hear you talking, it's like, it's so simple and it sounds so good. And I'm like, she's at the top of the pyramid, people. She's like at the top of the food chain. You know, like, I feel like, but that's why I want to talk to you, too, because I'm like, what's it like up there, Nicole? Tell us how the weather is.
In the creative self, the creative self is the top of the pyramid in the sense that you're deciding how, we decide how we live and who we are. So, and I think the greatest decision that we can make is to have peace. Mm-hmm. And then the next question is, okay, what do I need to maintain this peace and to connect to this peace. And it's like I said, it is less about the external space and really about the internal space.
Yeah. Okay, beautiful. Yeah, that was kind of leading me or took the answer from the next question that I wanted to present, which was, is it possible to find that creative space that's generated in an environment of peace if a person is worried about, let's call it survival, you know, or money, their bank account? Is that a possibility, or is it realistic that a person yes. can generate their creativity. Yeah, that's been my experience too. I'm like,
well, yeah, and then there's these other spaces of tension where you look at an artist like Miles Davis, Van Gogh, or you know, there's all different kinds of artists, where you look at different artists throughout time who, and this is where I kind of connecting into art as a healing practice, and that let's say you aren't feeling peace and there's lots of chaos happening around you. For me, making art is a refuge. So you can take refuge in your creative self, even if it's not the most optimal state for you to connect to your creative self. But as we start to take refuge more and more and more, we get into a habit, we create a pattern of, we build a rapport with our creative self. We start building that rapport and it becomes easier and easier to connect in, regardless of what's happening outside. Then as we connect more and more, we start to have more control over what's happening outside because we start to understand our abilities. And okay, and so that's one part. But the second part is that our creative selves are a hugely powerful tool for transformation and transmutation of our stress. So this could look like, for some people, journaling, just writing. Stream of consciousness, just getting it out. So if you're really worried and really stressed, it's like let's explore it, let's look at it. Don't let it just kind of hold it in. I think the creative self is like this function of transmutation, this function of healing, this amazing kind of almost fire, like a violet flame that just can take anything. It could take the most intense, most heavy thing and turn it into something so beautiful. And that's when you look at an artist like Miles Davis, where, you know, the struggles and the things that were happening in his life were immensely painful. And his music had this depth and this complexity that reflected that pain, but more so reflected that silver lining kind of note of genius that is ever present, regardless of if we're a monk sitting in, you know, a cave in silence, or we're standing in the subway in New York and there's chaos swirling around us, that is ever present.
Yeah.
So, and as we grow and as we start to build this rapport and build this relationship with our creative selves, we start to learn what we need. Some artists need and thrive and love chaos and stress and the intensity of that, and that feeds their work and their responding. And sometimes we go through phases where sometimes in our life we need that and other times we don't. I think that the key is really listening and connecting to our creative selves.
Okay.
And that's where we're going to thrive in all the different life conditions that we find ourselves in as human beings.
Yeah. It seems like a piece of what you're saying here is that for humanity to really shift in its relationship to having and to thriving and coming out of survival is to really embrace the importance of creativity in all of its expressions, or at least in the expressions that are inspiring for the individual.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's the thing that we,
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I want to just say real quick that it's also, you know, sort of tough to just integrate that, I think, in a global sense right away. But on the individual level, it's like, yeah, if we can tap into our creativity of how can I be more self-expressed so that I can generate an income that would give me the experience of, we could call thriving or well-being or enoughness. The opposite of whatever, the opposite of worrying for me is like security, well-being, enough, plenty, you know, enjoyment, play. Those are some of the feelings that I feel on the opposite end of, you know, worrying about money. So it's like, but in that like global sense, I feel like we don't really value creativity that much. That's like reserved for those artist people or for God. And that's it.
Yeah, I find I've always been surprised in my lifetime when people ask me, what do you do? And I say, I'm an artist. Almost everyone I speak with says, oh, I wish I was an artist. Unless they identify as an artist. They say, oh, I wish I was an artist. And so what you're saying is hearkening back to these moments. And I've always and believe and feel really strongly about the fact that really we all are artists. And that we are all creative beings because that's what an artist is, and I'd like that cultural paradigm to shift a little around the identity, our identities as humans. You know, being human. If you're human, you are an artist. You are the creative being. So whether or not means, you know, you look at shows like Chef's Table. I know that you know. Chefs are becoming more viewed as artists, and the art of food, the art of being a mother, you know, parenting, everything. It's the art of everything we do.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the key, is the art, like, you know, in the practices of meditation and peace generating practices, yoga, it's like the art of the moment, the art of washing your dishes, the art of putting on
the
your
art
shoes.
Of life.
Yeah, the art of life. That's beautiful. Yeah, that's beautiful. It sounds really liberating, and I love the for me, like, so much of life is about sensory, so I love that sensory experience of tapping into the art of life. Like, it just feels so liberating in my being, in my chest, in my heart. And with that said, I want to pause for a moment before we go into, I want to ask you some tougher questions, but before we do, I just want to check in for a moment and let people know, if you've just tuned in, you are listening to the Hypnotic Comic Show, and this is Jenna Grayson, and we are having the great privilege and honor of speaking with Nicole Buffett, the great artist and healer and granddaughter of the legendary icon Warren Buffett. And we're exploring creativity and the truth about money and the truth about scarcity and finding some liberation in all of that. So I appreciate you so much for joining me, Nicole. And I also want I want to save the call-in number if any of the listeners would like to call in and ask a question or make a comment to either me or Nicole. The phone number here is 888-627-6008. So coming into some of the tougher questions, you know, we're talking about liberation, and I'm really interested in the concept of, you know, money as a source of liberation, but I also know that it's really very much a source of imprisonment and suffering for so many people. You know, that people are controlled by wealth, even in the highest 1%, you know, there's people having the experience of having their freedom bought by one another, potentially bought by their own family members. And I know that your voice has been so important to you that it has come at a cost for you to be this creative and to be this outspoken and to take a stand for what's your creative truth and your voice. And so I just wanted to make some space for, you know, acknowledging what money is in terms of its relationship to true freedom, or a word I like even better than that is liberation, and you know, how it can imprison people. Oh my God, my dog. I got to let my dog into the room. Hold on a second. All right. So my dog is feeling imprisoned by the closed door. We've got to open the doors of possibility.
It's all a reflection. It's all working.
It's all the play of the moment. So I don't really know what my question is there. I'm starting to feel like I'm just like talking now.
No,
but there's something you want to contribute there. Yeah.
Well, thank you for saying that, because, you know, I've come through a long period where, you know, I made a choice when I decided to be a part of this documentary, whether I was fully conscious of that choice or not. I did make a choice, and I remember at that moment making a choice that, or I felt that there was nothing that you could that you couldn't give me anything in exchange for my freedom to share and express who I am and my story. So even if it meant that I was going to go outside of the box of comfort and even the rules of at that time, you know, kind of what was considered very taboo, was to, you know, make myself special or have myself stand out because of my being a Buffett. And it's a really fine line. And I had to follow that line. It's somewhere in my own compass, inside of my heart and my soul. And, you know, I chose the path of transparency and openness. And I, you know, I paid a big price in the sense that it absolutely, it rippled out in my family structure, and I definitely rebelled against kind of any kind of oppression that was going on. And it kind of evolved into this archetypal structure where I felt like it wasn't as much personal. It was personal. My need to share and express and feel the freedom and the ability, which I have, to talk about who I am with anyone who wants to hear, whether it's, you know, Oprah or you or anyone. I will always grant myself permission to share, because that in and of itself is the role of the artist. We are the storytellers. We are the, you know, some would say shamans of history and of time, where we reflect humanity back to it, onto itself like a mirror, so that we can see ourselves more clearly, so that we can heal ourselves. So I went through an intense phase of talking about what it was like to be Warren Buffett's granddaughter. And it led me closer, actually, to the place from which I started, which was how incredibly fortunate I am and have been to practice being an artist and to understand what that means. Let's see, where do I go from here? I'm gonna pass the.
That's great. You're doing great. It's really powerful and profound, and I appreciate it so much. I think I want to ask you, like, really directly. You know, you said that speaking about being Buffett, I love that phrase right there, it came at a cost for you, and I want to ask you, and this is not something you have to say anything specifically about your family, but I'm curious, you know, would you have, if you could be as honest as you can, would you have sold that for the right price? You know what I mean by that? That personal expression. Would you have sold that personal expression for the right price?
No, there's really no amount of money, because if I had, and I really believe that there was a price, I would have protected something that I thought belonged to me. But instead, I chose to protect that which I know belongs to me and that I'm not willing to sacrifice, which is really my life, you know, which is my... my purpose and my life is to share and to express. That's why, you know, I'm here. So to give that up is really no amount of money could ever make up for that loss. And it's also based on you know, you're either protecting a relationship, you know, which relationship is the most important relationship? Is it the relationship to the other? Is it the relationship to the self? And, you know, that's a question, and that's an experience I think that all humans are grappling with. But I think that I continue to return to the place of the relationship with the self is the relationship with the other. So there is no other unless there is the self. So that's one thing that, that we should never be asked to sacrifice and never really can actually sacrifice. So it's kind of a perfect setup for me to, the whole thing has been a really a wonderful a perfect storm of self-realization. So you know, it's like out of the coal with enough pressure becomes a diamond. And so it's one of those funny kind of almost oxymorons of, you know, how do we grapple with our limitations? Our limitations are actually our greatest assets, and they are the ones those are the places where we access our greatness. In that, okay, in you know. We know what we don't have, but what do we actually have? Because the more limits we have, then we realize, okay, where am I exactly? Who am I exactly? Beyond the things that are not happening. You know, if we can make a beautiful picture with just a pencil and a paper, that is one of the most profound things that you know you could do. It's the most simple medium, and what it's showing is the accessing of something far beyond the limitations of our lives externally.
That's right. Very beautiful. Very beautiful. I want to ask you one final thing. You know, it's like I feel like you were born into this family that has this extraordinary wealth, and then you were both asked by your family as well as chose to in many ways separate yourself from that great wealth. And I want to ask you what relationship, we just have a couple more minutes left so we can kind of try to wrap it up, but so hopefully this question isn't too complicated like most of my questions
here.
Thanks. So, you know, what relationship has separating yourself from the wealth, whether it be through your family's choice, your grandfather Warren Buffett's choice, or through your own choice to be self-expressed instead of to be connected to the money that in many ways you've been separated from as a result of your voice? Is that true? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I mean, my grandfather reacted pretty intensely to my coming out, let's just say, and sharing my story. And it was a big stepping outside of the box that a lot of the other family members at that time were really living inside of, this premise of kind of this unspoken golden family rule. And I just kind of stepped outside of that. And so it was a shocker, I think, for him to feel that loss of control to his, you know, his sphere of influence. So what is the question exactly?
Well, you know, I kind of didn't finish there, but that's great. I appreciate your sharing with that. And I also, you know, wanted to add to that, where is the placement for you in the separation from the money in your journey in self-healing and taking on that inner journey of, you know, what we could call healing or coming into wholeness? I know you have experiences with plant medicines as do I, and in that journey, it's like, do you think that the separation from the money brought you into the plant medicine journey, or that it just gave you, I don't know, like how would you
see
that?
I think separation from anything that feels like a source is an awakening kind of modality. I think that, you know, we all have loss, and I think that, you know, the more that we explore what we feel from, you know, in our shadow, our pain and our loss, and we start to really, in a playful way, which is, I think, the key with plant medicine work, is that you come together with a group of chosen people and you explore the places in your life that you'd like to heal, the shadow, and you're bringing it into the light. So really it's about that shining that light, shining that awareness, going beyond the fear and saying, this is scary and this is what scares me. And, you know, I realize I have these holes in my life here. And what is this about? And I think that it's that again, that's a creative act. And, you know, just asking those questions and taking that time to look at ourselves and with love and light in our hearts, ask ourselves, you know, kind of sit down, like one of my teachers said, sit down with your greatest fear and pour it tea and say, hi, you know, tell me a little bit more about you. I wasn't so sure. You scared me off so intensely with the whole monster mask thing and the blood, and it was really scary. But now that I've gotten past that, I'm actually kind of curious, you know, where were you? Yeah, where did you grow up? What high school did you go to again? So I think we met, you know, back then in the cafeteria.
Right. Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? Well, thank you so much. I love, love, love talking to you and
sharing with you.
Hearing your heart and soul. And yeah, I just really, really appreciate you so much, Nicole, and just the depth
I appreciate
of your
you. Thank
being.
You.
Yeah. So
well, I hope I shared something of value. I hope I shared something of value.
Absolutely.
And if anyone wants to connect with me, contact me, have me do some shamanic process painting for them, my email is artandhealingonthemountain@gmail.com.
Thank you so much.
So feel free to pass that on. And thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so, so, so much, Nicole Buffett. We appreciate you so much being on the Hypnotic Comic Show. And that's the end of our show. Thank you guys so much for listening. We'll be doing a show every week. I'm pretty sure I know my guest for next week, but I'm not sure yet. But for today, we are complete and appreciate you guys so much. I'll be posting more information on my Facebook page, and this is the kind of interview that I know I would love to listen to again and again. There's so much to take from and listen to and marinate in. And so thank you for sharing this wisdom, and thank you to my friend Doug for running the show, and we're so grateful for this opportunity. So I'm going to run for now. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Doug, and we will talk to you both soon.
Thank you.